Good evening, everybody. This is James McCanny with my Science Hour for December 12, 2019. A lot of topics to cover this evening. Actually, a few topics to cover. I'm going to be talking about what NASA should have done and should be doing. And this is not to describe anything that they have done. I'm going to be taking you on a little venture into where we should be today in the space program, and it's very, very, very different. I mean, I couldn't say very enough times. It's very, very different from anything that is going on, any of the visible space programs. But first, to mention on electric airplanes. Now, this is something I've been following for a long time, and being in the electric industry, literally, it's something that I knew was coming along. The European airplane manufacturer, Airbus, has been experimenting for quite a while, and a number of years ago produced a small one-seater, one-engine aircraft that had the batteries in the wings and flew for about 90 minutes. That's pretty good. That's a long time. I remember buying a kid's toy once. It was made out of styrofoam, so it was very light. And it had a little battery pack in it, rechargeable batteries. And this thing flew for, 20, 30 minutes. It just kept going and going. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. Because I knew at that point the technology was getting to the point where electric airplanes, big electric airplanes, would become commonplace. There's a company right now building jets that are basically small personal jets up to the size of the, say, a medium-sized Learjet, completely electrical. This is just the wave of the future. But the reason I'm mentioning this is because this week, a company called Harbor Air out of Seattle, or Bellevue, I believe, or up there in Vancouver area, had their first real flight, more than just skipping on the water, but took it up and flew. And it's interesting because the pilot was the CEO of the company. And what they're using is electric vehicles. These are what are known as Beavers, de Havilland Beaver. And the Beaver is an all-purpose pontoon plane, and they come in various sizes, but the main Beaver airplane that's been around literally since World War II was a tremendously powerful engine, and was used basically by bush pilots because it's so dependable. It was tremendously dependable, and I wanted to talk about this. I possibly have mentioned this on my show before, but when I was a little kid, I was born up on the Canadian border, and in a little town that was just a speck of dust on the map, and there was my grandparents' house where I basically was born, and when I was little was there. But in the summertime, this is right after World War II, I was born a couple of years after World War II. But anyway, I would sleep in the upstairs back porch, which overlooked a number of miles down and away the edge of the lake, the near bay of this great big lake that's up there. And that was the beginning of what became known as the canoe country. And that's something I did a lot as a youth, going out into the wilderness by myself in a canoe, backpacking and portaging and et cetera. That's where also I realized that I had a spirit and I could communicate with that spirit, et cetera. But anyway, back to the de Havilland Beaver. In the morning, and of course up there, this morning in the summertime comes at around 3:30 in the morning, the crack of dawn. And so as the dawn was breaking early in the morning, many miles down below where I was sleeping on the lake, you could hear the beaver engines cranking up, you know, and they were very loud, and it echoed through the whole valley. And one by one, the planes would take off. They would taxi down the lake and off into the distance, and the sound would fade away, and finally the last one would take off, and they would strap two or three or four or even four canoes onto the grid work that goes down to hold the pontoons. They would strap the canoes onto those, and then the passengers, the sportsmen, would have all of their gear in the beaver, and they'd fly off into the Canadian wilderness, where they would drop them off, and these guys would fish for however long their trip was, 3, 4, 5, 7 days, whatever, and then they'd fly in and get them out. And so, and then the other thing I did is, as they were bringing in the fish from these prize-winning fish, all the big fish they would keep and bring back, they would bring back the big trophy fish, of course, for mounting, and I would be at the outfitters' places to go down and watch them bring in these big fish. So anyway, that was my experience with the de Havilland beaver as a kid. So these planes have been around for a long time. You know, I won't tell you how old I am, you can probably guess. But these planes have been the hallmark, the staple for up in Alaska, up along the west coast of Canada, all around Canada, throughout the, in northern Minnesota and the northern lake areas where they had transportation needs to go in and out of these by the bush pilots, basically. And so now, interestingly enough, these planes, this is the first company that I'm aware of that's doing this. They're getting a good publicity, called Harbor Air. And they have their first de Havilland Beaver that has been certified, and they're actually going to start using it for short-haul, completely electric airplane. And the commentary from the owner, according to the news report, was that it was like a beaver on steroids. In other words, this plane had a lot more performance than the petroleum-based fuel motor. And anyway, they're converting their entire fleet, so I think that's tremendously exciting. That's really exciting news, because the world is going towards electric. And I've been talking about this. I'll just make a quick commentary for people who have not been listening to me. Maybe this is the first show they've listened to, or you haven't been paying attention. But literally all of the power companies, the electric generation power companies in the United States, are on the verge of bankruptcy. The PG&E was just one of the first ones. And the end result is that the people end up without power. It's unreliable. They have not been maintaining their networks. They're heavily invested in wind and solar, and primarily in nuclear power. These are all failing. They're economically failing. And so anyway, as the world tries to move towards electric cars, every major car manufacturer is moving towards electric cars. In fact, it is said that if a person is born today, they will never drive a gasoline or petroleum-based automobile, not even with biofuel. That's the move towards electric cars. So at any rate, I think that's very interesting. And of course, I'm in that whole industry. I actually sell EV charging stations as part of the wing generator accessories. So anyway, very exciting news there. Also, just want to let you know, I've been a busy person this week. I've had quite a few interviews, and we'll have a couple coming up. So I'm going to make these announcements so that you're aware of these. It's always good to listen, because on these other shows, I open up into different areas of my experience, my expertise. So, of course, every Wednesday morning, I'm a first hour guest with John Moore, the Liberty Man. And then yesterday, the second Wednesday of the month, I'm a guest with Daniel Brigman on the Power Hour. And so I was there yesterday talking about various topics, including the wing generator and how we spec out systems and some other commentary. And then yesterday I was a guest on Pastor Butch Paw radio show. And he airs also on WCCR. And then this coming Sunday, I will be a guest on James Fetzer's show. He used to call it The Real Deal, and I noticed in his email now he calls it The Raw Deal. Yeah. So as if you have been following what's going on with James Fetzer, he changed the name of his show from The Real Deal to The Raw Deal. Anyway, I'll be a guest on his show Sunday, talking about quite a myriad of topics. So back to the main science topic, I'm going to jump right into this. At the end of the show, I'll give you a little bit of a rundown of what's on my webpage going into 2020. I know it's Christmas time. Most of you are doing your shopping. My sales typically go down around Christmas time because people are buying, you know, Barbie dolls and iPhones and all kinds of things, you know, new running shoes for somebody or, you know, nice tie, I don't know, whatever they buy. And so my sales typically go down, and then after the first of the year, they bump up again. So at any rate, I'm not going to do a lot of advertising now. If you choose to support me, that's how I pay for what I do, is through your purchases. I don't have donations, no sponsors. I don't have advertisements on my webpage for anything else. It's just the things that you purchase that are things that I'm selling. That's where I get some income to cover the airtime. I pay for my own airtime. I don't have somebody or sponsor paying for my airtime, etc. Anyway, enough of that. So should we be seeing from a national space program? And so what I'm going to talk about where we should be today after 50 years of wasted money going through that ridiculous space agency called NASA. First of all, I'll just make a brief mention that we should have actual space science going on, which is not happening. They get so much mileage out of this Mars rover that they're going to send another one. It's really, it's really a very bad scientific investment. I'm not saying that going to Mars and sending a rover is a bad investment, but what happens to it is the cause of it being a bad investment. You're not getting good science out of it. The public certainly is not getting good science. So at any rate, but what should we be doing on Mars? What should we be doing on the moon? What should our space program look like? First of all, the United States does not have a rocket system. And we're borrowing rocket systems from other people. You have SpaceX, which if it weren't for SpaceX, NASA would have nothing. And, of course, most of the United States launches for military, for everything else, go out of Russia. The Russia heavy launch vehicles out of central Russia. So anyway, but where should we be? What should we be doing? After World War II, there was the SpaceX, the X-plane, the rocket plane program in which they took these up, a rocket plane under the wing of a B-52 bomber, and dropped them off. And that was the beginning of the space program. And then they just stopped that. They went to space capsules and rockets. And that program should have continued. And so here's what we should have had from the beginning. And this is really from the time I was a baby after World War II. What they should have done is build tanker vehicles, launch vehicles that took off from a runway, and had very heavy lift capabilities that with engines that exist that could go up to 60 to 80,000 feet. That would be about 12 to 15 miles. You're out of the thick part of the atmosphere at that point, and just nose this thing upward and launch a payload out of a basically a big tube, kind of like a rocket launcher. A rocket launcher is a tube with a tube inside of it, the tube being the inner tube being the rocket. And when it comes out, the fins flip out. You see these all the time. They use them for ground-to-air, surface-to-air missiles, etc., SAM, and it's basically a tube. And so that's the configuration, but you want to get the tube up to 10 to 15 miles up in the air before you launch the rocket. So, and then the carrier vehicle comes down and lands, picks up another module, flies up, and you can do this all day long. You could have a single carrier vehicle launching 10 to 15 times per day. And we wait a year, sometimes 2 years, between launches. Back in the space shuttle day, it was, I mean, what a disaster. So that's what we should have had. Now, with that launch capability, and let's say we had 10 or 20 of these launch carrier vehicles. And by the way, the one that they have designed, it's changed hands a few times. The Strato launcher, it's really a bad design, terrible, terrible design. The smaller versions of that same vehicle, the Burt Rutan White Knight, is a smaller version, but it doesn't scale to large sizes. As with many things in this world, they don't scale. And so the real design should be, it should look something like it's called a C-17, a Globemaster. And it's just a big tanker aircraft. That's what this should look like. And we should have fleets of these. We could have literally hundreds of these in our space program. So that's what the launch vehicle system would look like if I were in charge of NASA. This would work. We would have the youth of this country, part of grade school and high school programs, would be sending kids into outer space. That would be the level of population of outer space that we would have. In the history of NASA, less than 1,000 people have been in space. This is not for you. The NASA is designed to keep you from going into space. You can liken it to the Middle Ages when the church used to teach the commoners that the earth was flat and that you could not sail out to the ocean because you'd fall off the edge and there were fire-breathing dragons and there were hurricanes and all kinds of bad things and you were going to die. That's what they taught the common people. It's a similar thing in outer space today. I am a firm believer that Christy McCullough was a sacrificial lamb because every school kid in this country was watching the explosion of the space shuttle that day. And the message that was sent home was, hey, space is dangerous. You ain't going there. It's not a good place for civilians. That was the message. So in my space program, literally every kid in high school in this country would have an opportunity to go into space. And not just a quick ride, they would be able to go to, okay, this is the next step. We could have tremendous infrastructure in outer space. We would have rotating space stations, the kind that you saw in the futuristic movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. I saw that when I was in college in the late 1960s. And that's what we expected. This is late 1960s. By the year 2001, we expected space stations of that caliber. And oh boy, did we not get that. Did the United States ever get taken to the cleaners by NASA? And they're still being taken to the cleaners. NASA has never done anything. But anyway, if I were in charge back then, That's what would be going on today. You would have adults into space. Space tourism would be common. It wouldn't be something that people are just beginning to do right now, but with maybe six or eight people in a spacecraft, where they go up to the edge of the space and then glide back. No, we would have a massive presence in outer space. We would also be using electromagnetic propulsion systems, and this would be very commonplace for both in the atmosphere and outside the atmosphere. The going to the moon and back, there are radiation issues, and that's something that, because of my understanding of the radiation issues, I have solved. And I know how to go through the Van Allen radiation belts, and NASA does not. They're faking it. They're going to pretend like they're going to go to the moon in a couple of years, but I don't even want to continue talking about that. But there is a way to deal with space radiation, a very easy way to deal with this. So we would have autonomous space stations. I would say probably as many space stations as we have five-star hotels in the United States. That's how many space stations we should have right now, because it would be an economic business. It would be a viable vacation resort place for people to go into the beautiful realm of outer space. And it would be easy to get there. A flight into outer space would cost about the same as a tropical vacation. A couple thousand dollars for the flight, and maybe $200 to $300 a night for room and board. And, you'd go up for a week or two. Artificial gravity would be part of the system. I mean, it would just be understood. And there would be other kinds of excursions that you could have to go from one space station to another. There would be commerce. There would be manufacturing. We would have large-scale manufacturing in outer space. Now, here's a great example. If you take aluminum and you want to make, say, aluminum foil, you go to the store, you buy a roll of aluminum foil, you put it on your grill, or you wrap your food in it, or maybe you can do other things, you cover your stove burners with it. And after a couple uses or a little while, it tears apart and you throw it away and you get another piece. This is because the aluminum is relatively weak, because it's fabricated. It goes into this form in the atmosphere. If you could make an aluminum sheet that thin, the same thin foil that you're using to cover your stove or wrap your sandwich, if you could make that in outer space, it would be 1,000 times stronger. Now imagine that. That's just an example. How about transistor technology or manufacturing many things that are made in vacuum, including none other than carbon fiber? Carbon fiber uses a vacuum process to cure. So you could make carbon fiber materials in outer space much higher quality than what we have on Earth, because the vacuum would be much lower. That would be a much lower vacuum, a much less contamination in the carbon as the resin cures in a vacuum. And so on Earth, you have bagging, you have other types of heat curing of carbon fiber materials. But in outer space, you would get a much stronger piece of material. We would probably have carbon batteries by now, because there would be a lot of infrastructure going into batteries and fuel cells, and the use of oxygen, hydrogen fuel cells would be common in outer space, because oxygen and hydrogen are both very available in outer space. They're in plasma form, but they're very available. And so at any rate, now let's talk about the moon. Because the issue of radiation would have been solved, now understand, NASA has never gone out of low Earth orbit in its history. They allegedly went to the moon in the Apollo program, but after that, they shut down the Apollo program. The last visit to the moon was literally yesterday, 1972. So, you know, count the decades since the last time NASA allegedly was at the moon. But why didn't they ever go back? Why didn't they ever leave low Earth orbit? Why are they sending up spacecraft now to test for radiation if, you know, they sent, what, six lunar landings with three guys each? That's 18 people that supposedly went to the moon. They all came back. They all lived to be a ripe old age. No problems, no health problems, not a shred of evidence of radiation problems. And that's part of the big lie, because I dealt with Russian scientists in the mid-1990s, and they said that they had, in the 60s, they already had the capability of sending men to the moon. They didn't land on the moon. They just circled the moon and came back. And they came back very dead. They came back very radiation poisoned dead. And the reason was X-ray poisoning, X-ray burn, basically. The same kind of X-ray burn that someone would experience if you were at Chernobyl or Fukushima, that kind of radiation burn. And so at any rate, but there's a way of curing that. There's a way of dealing with that. And so part of the space infrastructure that we would have in place right now would be called a moon train. And how would the moon train work? Well, the moon train is literally a train. It would be a series of gravitational, artificial gravity systems. And when I say artificial gravity, now don't get the idea I'm talking about anti-gravity. I'm talking about artificial gravity, where the spacecraft spins and it creates the centrifugal force within the spinning, basically a spinning wheel, creates artificial gravity. And that's one of the biggest problems in going into outer space, is that people have a hard time adjusting to a weightless environment. It's bad for your circulation and bones. The people that come back from these long stints in outer space are really in bad shape. Nobody talks about that. Gravitationless environment is not good for the human body. You need that gravity for your blood, for your bones, for many parts of your biological system. Okay, and so artificial gravity is very important. But this, the moon space train would be a system of vehicles hooked together that go out around the moon, come back, orbit Earth, go back around the moon, and they just keep going constantly. So if you were going to go to the moon, you wouldn't go to the moon in a single spacecraft. That's stupid. That's ridiculous. That's asinine. That's NASA. What you would do is you would take off with one of the launch vehicles from Earth. You would go up into low Earth orbit. And when the space train came around, you would go up and dock with it. You would depart. And then the carrier vehicle would come back to orbit around Earth. And you would be on the train. It's about a six-day journey to go around the moon and come back. Another 6 days coming back, something like that. But that's how you would get to the moon. And the majority of people that would go to the moon would never land on the moon. It's much easier. Now, let me just discuss this for a minute. There's all of this hype about landing on the moon. Once you land on the moon, there's really no benefit to landing on the moon. You need to bring all of this extra equipment and land and propulsion systems just orbiting the moon. Now, if you wanted to, say, do mining or do scientific research or resource gathering on the moon, that's a different story. That would be up to private enterprise to discover what resources are on the moon. And then you know, maybe there'd be wars over this. Who's going to get what resources? Because there's treaties signed long ago, international treaties, that said that outer space was for everybody. Well, you know how that goes. The first guy there is going to start taking the the first thing there, and then the second guy there is going to go, hey, you can't take that, and then there's going to be a big fight over it. But be that as it may, the average person that goes out to the moon really has no business landing on the moon. There's no advantage to landing on the moon. As I said, it's stupid. There's really no point. And the majority of people that would go there would be just to as a vacation, as some place to go in outer space. Okay, now the next step, and we should have been to Mars with humans decades ago. Now, Mars is a very interesting place because something that I know for a fact is that Mars was a populated planet, and we know that from history. That's what Velikovsky was studying. That's what he was talking about, that Mars lost its atmosphere and oceans within the last many thousands of years. I'm not going to put a date on it, but the ancients talk about Mars being a blue planet, a water planet. And there were populations there, and apparently the orbit of Mars brought it much closer to Earth. That's when Venus, the comet, came through the solar system and wrenched, basically took the oceans and atmosphere off of Mars, leaving what we see today. I have a whole series of on the subpage that I have the picture of the day subpage, where I show all of the evidence for Mars having recent atmosphere. And of course, NASA has stolen my material, but then claimed that it's billions of years old. And of course, they have no evidence for that at all. But there again, going to Mars is a much bigger effort. It's a much bigger effort because only a short window throughout the cycle of Mars and Earth conjunction, there's only a short window where you can leave Earth and get to Mars. And by the time you get to Mars, Earth has already moved ahead in its orbit so that you can't get back to Earth. And so anyway, if you go to Mars, you're going to be there for a long period of time. Probably well over 2 years. And so that's why sending men to Mars, the people that are chattering about this today, are probably smoking some of that funny stuff. I understand that that's now legal in California, so maybe that's what's going on. They're smoking a lot of that and believing they're going to go to Mars. Believe me, nobody's going to Mars. Believe me, nobody is going to Mars. I would not put my money on that particular venture at all. It's a nice thought, but I'm sorry, the people don't understand the radiation hazards, and they certainly don't have the capability to get to Mars and weather being there for a number of years and then coming back, in spite of the great movie with Matt Damon. The real issue is, here is how technology advances. It advances one small step at a time. And so to go to Mars, you would have to send the first unmanned spacecraft that would have to perform all kinds of capabilities, and you would have to send exploratory vehicles that would prove technology. You don't want to go to Mars being what you might call the maiden voyage. Not a good plan. I certainly wouldn't want to be on that particular voyage because, simply put, there are, let's just put it this way. Man has not existed. Nobody has been in outer space, even in low Earth orbit, for the amount of time that would take you to go to Mars and back. And in low Earth orbit, you are being resupplied constantly from the Earth. You have, waste material coming back. You have fresh supplies and, fuel, everything you need. You're right here. You're right next door to Earth. There's Earth there, right out your window. You can see it. And your supply chain, and if something goes wrong, you can quick escape and get out of there and come back to Earth. And if you're going off to Mars, there's no escape hatch. there's no place to step out and walk home, buddy. You're on a one-way ticket you're going to Mars, you're going to be there for a number of years, and your opportunity to get back to Earth depends on your equipment working in a couple of years to get your behind back here. So, no, nobody's going to Mars. Nobody has developed the technology to even begin to go to Mars. So that's somebody's pipe dream. That's not even a pig with lipstick. There ain't no pig there. It's lipstick with no pig. It's a pig with lipstick and no pig. If we had an actual space program that was operating for the last 50 years, we might have been to Mars with people already. But the other issue with Mars, because we know it was populated and because of the high level of secrecy and because we know that the NASA Mars rovers as a sham, and they're not showing us the real images from Mars, I can tell you very clearly that the scientific, the real space program has been to Mars. And the reason they're keeping the public from Mars is because they're studying the leftovers, whatever is left of the races that were on Mars. They're studying that just like they are down at the South Pole. There's a lot of recent discoveries of human habitation of the South Pole. Well, how can that be? Well, that's because there was a pole shift, and the inhabitants of that region did not fare too well. And so they're probably all flash frozen, just like the mammoths up in Siberia are flash frozen. These people were flash frozen in their environment. So there's a pristine, basically archaeological find that's being kept from you, the public, dealing with Antarctica, dealing with Mars. But in a real space program, we probably would have been to Mars already. But then the other issue is that the rest of the solar system is not really habitable. You could send space stations to orbit the sun, and that's something that we should be, that we would also have. We would have autonomous space stations that would be orbiting the sun, potentially with up to 100,000 people on them. And these would be, that's the level that we could be at right now. There was another Matt Damon movie. He likes these outer space movies, but it was called Elysium, where there was a massive space station in the year 2154, futuristic, where the Earth is highly overpopulated and the rich people build this space station where they go and live in ultra luxury. But at any rate, that is not too far-fetched a story, but given that we had an actual space program. But what NASA is doing right now with their Orion program is trying to build basically a pregnant Apollo space capsule and try to wow us by trying to go to the moon again. And they say they are going to do this. They're going to send a woman to the moon in 2024. Well, don't hold your breath. I'm sure something will happen in the interim that will postpone that little gig. But they're not going to the moon. They have no capability. The few tests that they have done, it's absolutely absurd. But the issue is that the solar system is not a very habitable place. If you look at the other planets, Venus is not a habitable planet. Mercury, absolutely not, too close to the sun. And Jupiter is certainly not a place where you would want to go to. The radiation at Jupiter is absolutely incredible. Jupiter has its own radiation belts. It has its own fusion-based proton wind capacitor, and it has all of the radiation that comes from the sun. It's discharging the solar capacitor. So Jupiter is just a radiation nightmare, and so there wouldn't be any real reason to send people there. It's good to study Jupiter, And the same with Saturn, the same with Uranus and Neptune. None of the other planets really have, or the big moons have what you would call a habitable environment. And so we're kind of placed right here at our neighborhood around planet Earth in the orbit that Earth has around the Sun. And as far as venturing off to other star systems, that's a very interesting thought because as part of my own work, and this I presented literally a couple decades ago, work that I had done from the early 1980s, and there's two electromagnetic propulsion systems. One of them is publicly available. You can see it in my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. And the other one I have never released. And I'm not going to give any more details, but it's for interstellar travel. And I gave a talk back in the early 2000s on this called Electric Rivers to the Stars. And because of my work dealing with electrical discharges in the galaxy, there are electrical currents that move down the galactic arms. It's the discharge of the fusion-based capacitor, and you can ride those electric currents, just like the old sailors with a square rig could ride the wind currents in what basically they called the trade routes. But you can ride those electrical currents. And but anyway, the end result is that we could have spacecraft, at least exploratory spacecraft, that could have been already to other star systems. Not a problem. And I talked about this one night in my radio show about getting up to about 3/4 the speed of light, certainly not relativistic speeds, and how long it would take in the average distance to the nearest, or the average time frame to get to the nearest star is only 6 years, less time than it took to get to the planet Pluto with the New Horizon spacecraft. And so these are not out of reach times. And then it would take another 4 years for data signals to come back. We could actually be exploring the next star system already. But with NASA, they're trying to figure out how to get a mouse into space. They, you know, that's absolutely absurd. And the other thing is to have a balance between unmanned and manned space programs. Right now, the majority of NASA money is going into space programs for manned occupation of space. And they're very expensive, they're very costly, and they leave very little for exploration. Talking about exploration, when they built the Voyager, the Pioneer spacecraft, all these other spacecraft, the New Horizon, the Galileo, and the Cassini mission to Saturn, etc., they built one. They built one. They built one spacecraft that cost a tremendous amount of money. It would be like Henry Ford saying, "I'm going to build one car, and I'm going to drive it around." That's the equivalent of what NASA has done building unmanned spacecraft. Everyone is different. And what they should have done is settled on a design and sent out thousands of them. Then we would have real readings. For example, instead of sending a spacecraft to a comet, there should be hundreds of spacecraft circling the comet and taking data. And, of course, that's why NASA can fudge the data coming back from comets, because there really is no real data. They don't know what a comet is. They don't know how to build a spacecraft to study it. And the data that comes back, they always twist it and turn it to be commensurate with their ridiculous dirty snowball comet model. This is absolutely absurd what's going on. But now NASA doesn't have a space program. They have no intention of going out and doing, they have maybe a couple asteroid missions, but really, they don't have a space program dealing with unmanned exploratory space. And if I were a space scientist, you know, I don't know. If I were a space scientist that worked for NASA, It would be like going to work and, hanging around the coffee maker all day. There's nothing to do. But they should be very busy. They should have teams of astrophysicists and space scientists, that thousands and thousands of them working on these programs, studying other planets, exploring other planets with remote robotic missions. But literally, they have nothing, because they're dumping all their money into manned space programs, which basically the manned space program should have been taken over long ago by private industry. It's a very lucrative business if it's managed correctly. And right now there's some people looking at that, SpaceX and Blue Horizon, or what is it, Blue Horizon, and then there's the Bigelow Space Hotel people, the Richard Branson program, Virgin Galactic, I should say, where they apparently are going to start taking tourists into space this year. But I mean, we should be so far beyond this, and private industry is taking over the space tourism, and eventually maybe they'll be getting into manufacturing, taking up commercial payloads for manufacturing. But this should have all been done decades ago with private industry. We should be going into space should be commonplace, not something that people are paying $300,000 for a couple hour ride. You know, we should be so far beyond this. We should have had Stanley Kubrick's space station from 2001 in 2001, you know, literally, you know, 2 decades ago. And that should have been really done in probably the 1990s even. With the resource, I mean, literally these ideas were on the drawing boards in the 1960s, literally. And so, you know, to wait until the year 2001 and have nothing is absolutely beyond absurd. And also on planet Earth, we should be living in a pure electrical society. We were forced into this petroleum-based society and nuclear-based society back. That also began in, really during World War II and after World War II, where this petroleum economy was forced onto the public, and the petroleum economy literally goes back to the turn of the 1900s when Tesla was moving ahead. You had Porsche had electric automobiles in the early 1900s, and then it all changed. Remember, they ripped out the trolley cars from all the cities. There used to be electric trolley cars, just like San Francisco. I remember them in as a kid in the cities, go up to Minneapolis and St. Paul when I was a kid, and they had the electric trolley streetcar system that ran all year long, ran all winter, and was powered from the central, that was the way you got around going downtown, was on the trolley system. And then they tore those out to force people into personal automobiles. So at any rate, the amount of money, the amount of resources that went into personal automobiles was horrific. And then you were forced to have a petroleum-based automobile. And I talked last week, a couple weeks ago, also about petroleum-based economies, where in the 1800s, energy was not even an economic factor, to the point now where a hot dog costs $8 at the ballpark, and 95% of all of the cost involved in that, if you trace everything back, is in energy. So all that money, all that piece of the financial piece of that hot dog, goes back to the energy industry. But we should be living in a far different environment right now. Your house should cost about $30,000. There again, the vast majority of the housing cost, when you pay for your house, the vast majority of that cost is in energy to cut the wood, transport the wood, make the nails, create the cement, on and on and on. You know, it just an absurdity, the amount of human resources and expense have gone into energy that we never needed in the first place. It should have been, well, anyway, I'm not going to go into that topic too much tonight. But I hope this gives you a little bit better idea of where we should be in a space program. The launch system is the key. Having large, basically, jet or cryogenic aircraft that go up to 60,000, 80,000 feet, tip upwards, launch the payloads, and from there go into outer space. We should have, for example, if you go to a busy airport and you watch the planes coming in and out, we should have the equivalent of that kind of air traffic going into and coming back from outer space. That's the level of air traffic that should be expected by this time, by the year 2019, given that all of this was on the design boards back in the 60s. You know, and none of it has happened, none of it. Well, there's a good reason, because they don't want you to go into outer space. I often have said that, use this analogy, if NASA were given the edict to explore the Old West back in the covered wagon days, they would have built one covered wagon with all the amenities. They would have maybe four people cross over the Great Plains, and when they got to the West Coast, the word would come back that there's nothing there, and it would be classified as top secret, and the people would be kept in the dark as to what was there. That's what would happen if NASA were given the edict to explore the Old West. But instead, they opened it up, the people got in their covered wagons and walked and developed this great country. That's what should be going on in outer space. Okay, I'm going to switch topics here just a little bit to remind you what's on my webpage. Get ready for this coming year. If people have written in about the containers, the shipping containers, or the wing generator, etc., be patient. We're getting to the emails and the requests for information. But here's basically what I've done. And if you notice how I work, I'm very organized. And because of the different fields I'm in, for example, the wing generator, now I brought online the ability to sell shipping containers, because I needed shipping containers for my customers. A lot of them don't have sheds. They need electric, they need very sturdy buildings that will go out in very harsh environments to store equipment, electronic equipment, battery systems, or whatever. Or other equipment like, say, generators, various types of wiring. And so I needed the containers. So now I have the ability to get containers. And also, the factory can cut doors and windows and customize them, put internal walls in. And so that when they're delivered to somebody's site, they're ready to finish off and make some kind of a living structure, or it might be a shop that you want. You might want certain internal walls. And so these are 20 foot, 40 foot, 45 foot, and 53 foot shipping containers. Brand new. I don't sell anything used. Everything is brand new. You can get, if you want a single container that's used, you can usually get a pretty nice one that's used. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes the doors are all banged up, or the doors don't open properly. I don't sell any of that. I don't deal with anything used. And I don't pre-ship anything to save on shipping costs. When you order a shipping container from me, you will be paying the shipping cost. And so that can be a part of the overall cost. But I'm not going to have some kind of freight shipped in your shipping container and then give you a used shipping container. These are empty, never been used, shipped direct to your location, any place in the United States. So that's new on my page. Of course, I have Numana Foods that are there. And by the way, things are getting pretty crazy out here. I've been on quite a few radio shows as guest, And every person that I talk to believes that the United States is being driven into a very polarized country on purpose to create a civil war. And so there are people who want their own energy, their own water filtration systems, their own water storage systems, their own food. And so what I've done is position myself in all of these industries. So if you look on my webpage, I'm selling Numana Foods. I have very good pricing and free shipping, something that you won't find anyplace else. Of course, all my water filters, I have atmospheric water generators, reverse osmosis, water storage, and water analysis. If you send me, go to the webpage, I'll give it to you, the webpage in a minute. Go to the webpage, send me your zip code and your water company, and I will analyze your water for you and send you a report back, because believe me, you're going to be very shocked and amazed what's in your water. The federal studies are now available, and I can go into them, locate your water company, and tell you what's in your water. And believe me, your water company isn't going to tell you. What they're going to tell you is they comply with federal standards. Well, let me tell you something. Federal standards have not been updated in a lot of places in 30 years. And so that's a joke. That's a cop-out. And then I have the wing generator, marketing now from 2 to 50 kilowatt models. And those are custom systems. We have to look at your location, the wind, what your energy needs are, what your future energy needs are, and then spec out a system. And, of course, the shipping containers, the single containers, various sizes, or design a building with shipping containers, and we'll build it at the factory, deliver it to your site, ready to finish out, put in carpeting, put in, they come with a standard shipping flooring, which is wood, very, very hard as nails wood, and brand new. You can choose your color. You can choose all the colors you want for your buildings. And then also along with the wing generator, electric car charging stations, electric furnaces, water filtration, etc. So energy, water, food, shelter, and transportation. These are all available on my webpage. I'm not selling electric cars yet, and I probably will not unless I come up with a very good deal. But the EV charging stations, the electric car charging stations, are available with the wing generators as an option. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and take a look around, see what's there, plus scientific information that you will not find any other place in the galaxy, believe me. Once again, this is Jim McCanny, my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.